Okay. I have some sheets. This was the study source this past Shabbat. And you can just pass those around. I'll read it out loud. You can do with it as you will, but it's kind of, it has to do with what we do here. It's a rabbinic source from Seder Eliyahu Zuta. A king had two slaves whom he loved intensely. He gave one a measure of wheat and a bundle of flax. A measure of wheat and a bundle of flax. The intelligent one wove the flax into cloth and made flour from the wheat, sifted it, ground it, kneaded it, baked it, and set the bread on the table on the cloth he made before the king returned. The stupid one didn't do a thing with the gifts the king had given him. After some time, the king returned to his house and said, "My sons, bring me what I gave you." One brought out the table set with bread on the tablecloth. The other brought out the wheat in a basket and the bundle of flax in it. What an embarrassment that was. Which one do you think was more beloved? Similarly, when the Holy One gave the Torah, when the Holy Blessed One gave the Torah to Israel, he gave it as wheat from which to make flour and flax from which to make clothing through rules of interpretation. So just remember that this is called a Mashal Lamelech, a parable of the king, and often in the Midrash when there is a parable or a Mashal, the king is God, and the idea here, of course, is that the Torah is flax and wheat from which you must bake bread. And you do that by interpreting the Torah, and today we're going to do it by beginning the story of Sodom. Okay. Thanks. These are extras, if anybody would like that. I'll just put them in the pile of stuff we've given out over the past year and a half. 2 years, however long. How long? 2 years? We've been doing this 2 years. Well, it's a nice tie. Okay. Let's turn. We'll need in a couple minutes to look at some other verses and maybe even another episode in the Torah. But for the moment, let's turn to chapter 18, verse 17. Chapter 18, verse 17, so that we can begin with Sodom. Now, what has just happened? Do you remember? What happened just before Sodom? Right. Yes. Right. All those things. Right. It was essentially, I mean, the most important is that it was an announcement of Isaac's coming. That was the episode, of course, of Sarah's laughing in disbelief or whatever. And then we get to, actually, verse 16. Start with verse 16. The men, once again, the men are the angels, set out from there and looked down towards Sodom, Abraham walking with them to see them off. Now, who lives in Sodom? Lot lives in Sodom. Right, and has lived in Sodom since chapter 13, which we will come back to that in a minute. There's a reason why I mention that. Now the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham is to become a great and populous nation, and all the nations of the earth are to bless themselves by him, for I've singled him out that he may instruct his children and posterity to keep the way of the Lord about what is just and right, in order that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised him." I read all of that because there is a lot in that. First of all, it is not unprecedented, but it is certainly uncommon for us to be led into God's thoughts. Right? Here we have an internal monologue of God's. Should I tell Abraham what I'm about to do? Now, we've had this before. We've seen God deliberate. If you look back in chapter 6, you will see God deliberate in verse 5, where God says, right before Noah, "The Lord saw how great was man's wickedness on the earth, and how every plan devised by his man was by his mind was nothing but evil all the time. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on earth, and his heart was saddened." So there's one, the first glimpse inside the mind and emotions of God. And then we have another one 11:6, the Lord came down to look at the city, chapter 11, verse 6, 5, it begins with 5, that man had built. And the Lord said, if, as one people with one language for all, this is how they've begun to act, then nothing that they may propose to do will be out of their reach. Let us go down and confound their speech so they'll not understand one another's speech. Now, who's God talking to there? I mean, himself, the angels, but it's still God's thoughts. So there, too, we're let into God's internal monologue. We get to know what God thinks. And here, again, we know what God thinks. The first time, it's the second time, and this time, all three times, it's about confounding human plans or destruction. That's what God has internal monologues about. Am I going to destroy the world in the time of Noah? Am I going to destroy the Tower of Babel and scatter the people? Am I now going to destroy the cities? Actually, five cities are mentioned, but Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah, as we'll come back to, are the ones that are usually highlighted. But we'll talk about that when we get to it. Yeah.
I had this discussion with a rabbi yesterday in Beshalach. Mm-hmm. It says, God, the people may have a change of heart, says God. Mm-hmm. When they see war and return to Egypt,
right?
Unquote. So God led the people around about. We are led into God's deceptive thinking.
Not God's deceptive thinking.
Well,
I wouldn't call it that. I would call it God's strategic thinking. He thinks this: if I go this way, it's going to be bad, so I'll lead them that way. That's not deceptive. God never says to them, this is the shortest route, and it's not. God just says, you're going to go this way. Right. But yes, we are led into God's thinking there. Absolutely. That is a parallel.
And it was very odd when I read it.
Doesn't happen that often, but every now and then. Right. Every now and then you get to do what Einstein said was his life's mission, which is to know the mind of God. Right? Except we do it on a biblical level. But let's take a closer look at what is going on here in this chapter. First of all, there's a lot of this has to do with the idea that now that Abraham has been chosen and given a child, now that Isaac is coming, the question is, what is Abraham going to teach him? And it has to be established that Abraham's going to teach him the right thing, otherwise the whole mission is ruined. Because the mission is, obviously, that Abraham should do what? Right. Well, even more than lead the nation is provide offspring that will be a model for the world and enable them to teach those who come after the way human beings are supposed to be. So you have to make sure that Abraham's teaching the right stuff. If he's not teaching the right stuff, then you don't get, right? Then you don't get the mission fulfilled. Up to now, God has tried with humanity and it hasn't worked. So when he says, there was one other quote I was going to bring from Amos, which you don't have to look up, but I'll read it to you. It's from the third chapter of Amos, just in case you should. Some of you have this, and some of you don't, depending on whether you have a complete Tanakh or not. It says, chapter 3, verse 7. Indeed, my Lord God does nothing without having revealed His purpose to His servants, the prophets. And that's the verse that a lot of commentators bring here, that God doesn't do anything in this world without the Nevi'im, the prophets, knowing that it's being done. Now, whether there are still prophets is a separate question, but at least in the time of Amos, that's what he was saying. All right. Now, let's take a look at those verses more carefully. Since Abraham is to become a great and populous nation, and all the nations of the earth are to bless themselves by him. Right? Have we heard that before? Right, that's the very outset, chapter 12 of Abraham's way. Vayivrechu v'cha, through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. So since they're going to be blessed by him, he has to know my designs. Otherwise, there's no blessing here. Right? He has to know what God is about. For I have singled him out. Why? Why did God single him out? Yes, and what is that plan? This is a little bit of a trick question here. Why has God singled him out?
He
goes on to say, "For I've singled him out that he may instruct his children and his posterity to keep the way of the Lord." That's why God singled him out. God tells us very explicitly, "I singled Abraham out so that he and his children can teach the way of the Lord." And I came across a very nice quote from Martin Buber. He says that the way of the Lord is not a metaphor. It means the way of the Lord is the actual movement of God through the history of the world. It's the way of the Lord through history. So what is Abraham doing? He's teaching the world to recognize God's movement through the world, God's way. When you see this happened, that's the hand of God. That's what Abraham has to teach them. It's not the hand of lots of little gods who are warring with each other or idols. In fact, this is the way God works in the world. And that's going to be Abraham's mission, to instruct the world to know that and to recognize it. How do you keep the way of the Lord? By doing what is just and right. When you see justice and righteousness, that's the way of the Lord. In order that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. So there are two aspects to that. One is that the world has to recognize all this for Abraham's promise to come about, right? The world can, to some extent, thwart the realization of God's promise. If the world doesn't see a certain justice and righteousness, then God's promise won't come to pass. And you can certainly think of historical examples of this, right? When did the state of Israel come to be? It was in a brief spasm of realization on the part of the world of the justice and righteousness of the Jewish position following the Shoah, following the Holocaust. And the second half of this is not just that you can see God's way in the world and that the world can aid Abraham and his descendants in realizing it, but that also Abraham himself has to do justice and righteousness in order for God to bring about what God wants. So you can already assume that this might be a test, because God wants to see Abraham's sort of ethical metal, M-E-T-T-L-E. That means what he's made of. And he's going to find out in a minute with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Yeah. Yes. Yes, by some. It is. The tests, I will remind you, I'll tell you which ones we've looked at so far. There are different trials in different countings. There are different enumerations of what the trial is. Here's the one that we looked at from Leonard Cass's book. He answers the call. That's the first trial. Sarah's trouble in Egypt is the second trial. And I gave this sheet out, and I'll be happy to give out. I have other copies, and I can certainly make more. I have a whole bunch here. Is the second trial. Trouble with Lot is the third trial. Then Lot in trouble is the fourth trial, right? Because Lot gets in trouble with the kings. Remember, the first is trouble with Lot. He's got to divide the land. And then the fifth one is Lot is in trouble because he gets taken captive and Abraham has to fight to get him out. Hagar, the story with Hagar and Sarah, the circumcision, the hospitality to strangers, Sodom, then Sarah gets in trouble again with Gerar, and Ishmael and Isaac. The parting with Ishmael and Isaac. He gives 11, but I think we had another enumeration, if I'm not mistaken. But both of them. Where's the other one? I don't see the other one at the moment. But both of them carry Sodom as one of the. Oh, here they are. Here's Rashi and Ramban. I had Glenn Cass's and then Rashi's and Ramban's. We gave them all out, and I said I would give them out again at the end of the Avraham story when we've gone through all the. Rashi gives, Abraham hid underground for 13 years from King Nimrod, who wanted to kill him. This is based on the Midrash. It's based on the Talmud. And we talked about why back then. And then he was flung into an Esh Kivshan, a burning furnace. This is a very powerful and pervasive motif in the story of Abraham. That early on, he was thrown into Ur Kasdim, means an oven, the city he came from. So the rabbis assume that he came literally from fire in the same way that Daniel came from the lion's den. Anyway, those are the first two for Rashi. Rashi, who is the classical biblical commentator, repeats all the rabbinic stories and so on as if they're biblical. He sees them as one seamless web. Abraham's commanded to leave his family. As soon as he arrives in Canaan, he has to escape a famine. Sarah's kidnapped by officials. The kings capture Lot. God told Abraham his offspring would suffer. Rashi counts that as one of the trials he has to hear. Remember that they're going to go through slavery. Not an easy thing to hear. He has to circumcise his son. He drives away Ishmael and Hagar. He sacrifices Isaac. Those are Rashi's 10. And finally, Rambam's 10, his exile from family and homeland. Remember, Rambam, Maimonides, is the rationalist. He's not going to give you any rabbinic stories as one of Abraham's trials. He's only going to give you... So, Abraham's exile, the hunger, the famine, after God told him you would be a great nation. So it's a sort of double trial in one. He was expecting to be great. He gets there and he's starving. The corruption in Egypt that results in the abduction of Sarah. It's not just the abduction of Sarah for Rambam. It's being in a country that is corrupt. That's a trial by itself. The war with the kings. His marriage to Hagar after having despaired that Sarah would ever give birth. Right? He considers that a marriage because they had a child together. The commandment of circumcision. Avimelech's abduction of Sarah, which we're going to see in the next one. Driving Hagar away after she'd given birth. The distasteful command to drive Ishmael away. And the binding of Isaac on the altar. He does not include Sodom. Why that is, maybe we'll understand at the end of the story. Okay, so this is also the first time, and this is really crucial, this little speech of God's is the first time that God has said that the covenant depends on the moral behavior of Israel. Up to now, God has said, I'm going to make you a great nation, and you will be great, and we struck a covenant, but God never said, you have to be good. You have to walk in my ways. You have to do justice and righteousness. Right? This is the first time that righteousness and goodness are part of the deal. And it's when God is thinking to God's self. And notice that it's against the backdrop of the wickedness of others. That's when God emphasizes the necessity of Abraham to be righteous when Sodom is not. Which means that when you see other people acting wickedly, it imposes a special burden on you to be righteous. And this Shabbat, I'm going to talk about the Muhammad cartoons. Okay, I don't know why that came up. But we're not going to talk about it now. All right, there was one other. Oh, so let's look now at the three sentences. Abraham is to become a great and populous nation, and the world is to bless themselves by him. For I've singled him out. Why are they going to bless themselves by him? Because I've singled him out, and his children and posterity are going to do what's just and right. And by doing that, Abraham is going to get what he promised him. So both of those, and it emphasizes, as Sarna says here, that in the Bible, the education of the young is the responsibility of the parents. Remember, the idea of schools did not exist yet. Even though the rabbis see, you know, Isaac going off to a yeshiva after the sacrifice, after the Akedah, they say, where did Isaac go? Because Abraham comes down the mountain. It doesn't say Isaac came down the mountain. So their answer is that he went off to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever, that he went off to study. But it doesn't... The Bible doesn't say anything about any kind of organized schools. And in fact, as far as we know, there were not schools anywhere in the Jewish world until Rabbi Yoshua ben Gamla, who set up the first Jewish schools in rabbinic times, for which he deserves to be remembered. So, what's that? About the first century, second century CE. I don't remember his dates, but I could check. However, the first schools that we know of in the world were set up in the Semitic world in Sumer, right? In the Assyrian culture of Sumer. I remember when I was in high school, we read what was at one time a very famous book by Samuel Noah Kramer, who is an Assyriologist, called History Begins at Sumer. And he talked about the fact that the first alphabet, the first schools, lots of the first governmental bureaucracies that we know of were all from Sumer, which was... along the Fertile Crescent, the place that Abraham traveled. And it's clear that much of Sumerian culture, Assyrian culture, affects Jewish, early Jewish culture as well. Yeah.
I'm sitting here shaking because your emphasis on the way. God tells us what Abraham's job is, to show the way, which is the total radical departure when Jesus says, I am the way. And surely he knew that. And he knew the radicalness of his statement. Whether he believed himself to be God, or whether he
was well, it's a very interesting thing, but I don't want to start getting into the question of Jesus in the New Testament, or we'll never extricate ourselves. I mean, that'll be a different question. But as one of my teachers said to me, if you read the Brit Chadasha, the New Testament, in Hebrew, almost a sentence doesn't go by without very powerful echoes of both the Bible and rabbinic literature. We don't feel it as much because we only know the New Testament in English. But if you read it in Hebrew, you see constant echoes, which makes sense because Jesus and all of his early disciples were Jews, and they spoke the same language and used the same quotations. So yeah, there's all sorts of resonances. I mean, when you call, for example, when Jesus is called Son of Man, well, that's what all the prophets are called. Ezekiel is called Ben Adam, Son of Man. That's what God calls him hundreds of years before Jesus comes along. So anyway, so there's no getting out of that, you know. Yeah. Yes. Well, it says banav, which could be his sons or his children, and then it says beito acharav, his house after that. The issue of, you know, this is an interesting question. Theodore Friedman, who was a rabbi and a scholar, who I think passed away a few years ago, although I'm not sure. He wrote an article that has since occasioned a lot of discussion about why it is that the position of women in the Bible is much higher than the position of women by the time of the Talmud in the Roman Empire. And that's his answer, is it has to do less with Jewish culture than it does with the Roman Empire. That in the time of the Bible, women played a very big role. In Rome, women played a very small role. That's why if you watch all these, if you watch things like I, Claudius, there's always a scheming wife in the background. But never in public life, always in the background, scheming, because that's the only way that she can have power. She can't have power in any public sense. The same reason why historians think that witchcraft was associated with women, because it was the only means by which women could exercise power was by magic, because they had no legitimate public power. But the Semitic world, it doesn't seem, was that way. So, and part of the reason may be that public spheres and private spheres weren't so split off yet. But the more public became public, the more men's discomfort, I think, with having their wives be in public tended to push the realms apart, as well as lots of other things. So that led to the division of home and public, that to this day, if you ask traditional men and women, they will tell you that these are distinct but equal realms. And that, I mean, I just had this discussion by email, and after three or four exchanges, I said, you know, let's agree to disagree, from someone who identified himself as a conservative Jew, although I think his opinions and discussion weren't really anywhere that I could locate in the conservative movement. I think he's better placed in the Orthodox movement. And he said, essentially, if you think that this is discriminatory against women in any way, why don't you just ask Orthodox women? They don't think so. To which I have to acknowledge, I said, of course, you're right. There's no question that people generally speaking, who choose in a voluntary society a certain role don't choose it because they think it's discriminatory. That doesn't eliminate my sense that there's no way to say, from my point of view, that the position of someone in any society where they don't get to choose their own position is not discriminatory. Because in Orthodoxy, there are no female poskim. Poskim are legal decision makers. And as long as all the laws are made by men, which they effectively are, it seems to me an unequal system, even if the people in it don't think so. But I'm going to leave that aside because I don't want to talk about the position of women right now in the Bible or the Talmud. If this is about that, let's leave it aside, because that's too big a discussion. But the specific question is, it depends on the surrounding society. Yeah. Right.
And Avram being the high father is kind of clear. And then Abraham would be the father of them rather than the father of one. And something that you've emphasized is that Sarah was the progenitor who is of us only. Right.
Yeah.
And then I was looking at the word Israel. And Sar, that part of the word Israel, that root, being in Sarah's name, I think is something, there's something there about why I've never quite understood.
I don't know if there's a connection. I've never heard Sar being used actually as the root of Yisrael. I've heard it of Sarah, but not of Yisrael, although it could be. So I can't tell you. I've always heard Yisrael having the only root, the only translation that I've ever heard is struggle with God, Yisrael, or wrestling with God. I've never heard it as a prince of God, although that makes sense, could be. However, but part of the problem also, again, with names in any ancient culture is like it's like a Russian novel. The same names get repeated over and over and over and over again, and you can make a lot of the conjunction, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Yisrael is related to Sarah until you see how many names in that world had Sar in them, which I would guess would be quite a number. So I don't know. And it also depends whether that's, I mean, at least as far as I know, that's not the commonly given root of Yisrael, but we'll see when we get to it, we'll see what the scholars have to say about it. Okay, let's continue. Then the Lord said, "The outrage of Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so grave." Okay, he doesn't say what it is. He just says that it's terrible. And we'll talk about what the sin of Sodom was in just a minute. Erda nava ereh, I will go down and see. There was another time, I don't know if any of you remember, when God says, I'll go down and see. That was in the Tower of Babel. And the idea here is that God has to come into the place of the people who are sinning before judging. Right? You have to actually enter into their world and mindset before you judge them and what they've done. So, hakitza'akata, which means an outcry, like a painful, something terrible that has happened and someone is crying out to God. I will go down to see whether they're acting according to the outcry that has reached me, and if not, I'll take note. I will know. Eda'a. If not, I will know. So, God goes to investigate whether what they've done and what it means. I also wanted to say, before I move on to what the sin of Sodom might be, where is it? In verse 19, go back, where it says, "For I've singled him out." What's the Hebrew there? Anyone? Yadativ, right. Which means what? Right. For I have known him, right? Yadativ from Yodea. What could it possibly mean? And this is why the JPS translates I've singled him out. Because what could it possibly mean to say that God's only known Abraham? I've known him, and I haven't known anyone else? Okay, that's why they go with singled him out, because that I've interacted with him. But what do you think the traditional commentators say? Well, remember, look, actually, the way that you might want to interpret this is by looking at chapter 4, verse 1. What does it say? Adam knew Eve. What does that mean? Okay. In the case of Adam and Eve, it's clearly sexual, right? But now translated to God and Abraham.
Penetration.
Okay, I don't know whether you said it's penetration. I think I was thinking more spiritually. That is what Rashi and most of the commentators say is Abraham, I've loved. Right? Because that's the expression of love. That's the physical expression of love. And since you can't have a physical expression of love with God, still yadativ means I've loved Abraham. Now, the reason that I point that out is that what happens again and again in the Bible, even though we don't like to think of it that way, is that we don't know why God chooses whom God chooses. That never says Moshe was the best person going and God chose him, or Avraham was the only one who was good and God chose him. I mean, the rabbis come along and say that, but the Bible doesn't say it. If you just read the Bible, your sense would be that God falls in love with the people that God falls in love with. And certain people capture God's heart. And Avraham, for whatever reason, because it's always inexplicable, captures God's heart. You know, it's Montaigne, the French essayist, has a beautiful essay on friendship, in which he talks about his friend, Étienne de la Boétie, who died. And he says, if you ask me why he was his friend, I will only say because he was he and I was I. What else? You can enumerate all the characteristics, but then someone else can come along who has the exact same characteristics and you don't like them. So God fell in love with Avraham. And he says, I've known him, which is another way of saying I've loved him. That's at least how Rashi understands it. Okay, so now let's go back to chapter 18. The outcry reaches to God, verse 22. Now the question is, what did they do? And let's stop here for a minute and see if we can figure out. And here it's helpful to have a Tanakh, that is to have. But I'll read you the citations. My Tanakh is under there. First of all, remember that we already know something about Sodom. Because if you look back in Genesis 13:13, it says, Abram remained in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the plain, pitching his tents near Sodom. Now the inhabitants of Sodom were very wicked sinners against the Lord. Yes.
Can I go back 1 second?
Sure. Absolutely.
It reminds me actually of something that you once said a long time ago, something about love. Which is that the only way that someone can love you is to know what causes you to hate.
Right. That's a Hasidic story. I'll tell you in a second. Yeah. Born in love. Yeah, go ahead.
I also think it's also more than that, it was respect and love were also Abraham saw himself in God.
And each of them in the other. So let me just repeat, there's a Hasidic story about a rabbi who said he learned the meaning of love from two peasants who were talking to each other, and one of them said, I love you. And the other one said, do you know what hurts me? And the first one said, no, I can't, tell me what hurts you. And the second one said, how can you say you love me if you don't know what causes me pain? And he said that he learned that the definition of love was knowing what causes someone pain. And so Ellie said that God knows now what causes Abraham pain, because he saw him be childless, and out of that was born the depth of this love. And then Gita said, and Abraham has seen that in God too, because up to now, obviously, God, you know, seeing the what Sodom and Amorah are doing, seeing Abraham and Sarah suffer through the famine, Abraham thinks that he has also seen pain in God. And biblically, there clearly is pain in God. I mean, we may not think of it that way, but in the Bible, God gets angry, is clearly pained, regrets, all those things. So, the turning back now to the sin of Sodom, it just says that they're wicked, but doesn't say what they did. So let me, later on, the Sodom story is one of the stories that is mentioned a couple of times by the prophets. And if we look at what they say, it may tell us, it may give us some insight into what was going on in Sodom. This is what Jeremiah said. Where does he... Okay. What I see in the prophets of Jerusalem, okay, this is Jeremiah talking about the prophets of Jerusalem. You think the prophets of Jerusalem were all good guys? Nope. Leadership has always been problematic. That's all I can tell you. This is Jeremiah speaking already, you know, 2,500 years ago. What I see in the prophets of Jerusalem is something horrifying. Adultery and false dealing, they encourage evildoers so that no one turns back from his wickedness. To me, they are all like Sodom and the inhabitants of Amorah, of Gomorrah. So in other words, those are the sins that Jeremiah saw in Sodom and Amorah. And now let me read you what Ezekiel said. Ezekiel, one of the other of the three major prophets. Ezekiel in chapter 16 says as follows. Only this was the sin of your sister Sodom. Lack of communication. No. Only this was the sin of your sister Sodom. Arrogance. She and her daughters had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. In their haughtiness, they committed abominations before me, so I removed them, as you saw. So it's arrogance and indifference to the poor is the sin of Sodom, according to Ezekiel. And according to Jeremiah, it's adultery, encouraging evildoing, corruption. But both of them... and then the one other thing is back where we are, what does it say in chapter 18, verse 19 about Abraham? It says, I've singled them out, instructed his children and posterity to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is just and right. And then God goes and destroys a city. So presumably there's a contrast there. You destroy a city that doesn't do what is just and right, right after you told Abraham to do what's just and right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that hasn't really been telescoped to places like Sodom. So who is to judge them as being non-righteous when no one has come to say, let's explain what righteousness is?
Well, the question is, you know, how does Sodom know what's righteous? Remember that ever since the time of Noah, the Bible has assumed that all the world has to observe the seven Noahide laws. And those are basically, not exactly, because one of them is to set up a system of courts, one of them is not to remove a limb from a live animal, but basically they are the Ten Commandments minus the cultic ones, right, minus the specifically ritual ones. And it's clear from the Torah that that's expected of every human being, and that you don't require a special instruction in that, and that people are able to do that even without knowing in advance that's true. The Jewish people traditionally has expected that of the world. In fact, I heard a beautiful story. Our guest scholar this Shabbat, Reuven Kimmelman, told me a great story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that when because we were talking exactly about this, the seven laws, seven Noahide laws, the laws of B'nai Noach, they're called in Hebrew, the sons of Noah. Pat Moynihan, who was the senator of New York, came to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. As you know, leaders in New York would come to see prominent Jewish leaders about all sorts of things. So he came to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he was, you know, asking him for his support and whatever and so on. And at the end of the meeting, Lubavitcher Rebbe said, "Now I have something to ask of you." And he figured, okay, that's fair. You know, this is what it means to be a senator. You ask for support, and then they ask for something for their constituents. And Lubavitcher Rebbe said, "There's a community in New York, the Chinese. They're good family people. They care, they educate their kids. But I don't think they know the system very well, and I'm afraid they're getting taken advantage of by their politicians and by the courts. I want you to help them." Now that is, he believes that that is the responsibility. That's a seven laws of the sons. He doesn't say, you know, he didn't say convert them. He didn't say teach them to keep kosher, have them stop eating pig snouts. You know, that wasn't his agenda. His agenda was moral for the world, which is exactly the way the tradition tells us that everybody is supposed to behave. And the Sodom, in that sense, is a good example, which is that God didn't expect Sodom to keep Shabbos, but they expected them to feed the poor. And the lack of doing that was a sin. So, anyway. Isn't that a beautiful story?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so too. Okay. So, in verse 22, it says, "The men went from there to Sodom while Avraham remained standing before the Lord." Now remember, this goes back to verse 16, where it says, "The men set out from there and looked towards Sodom, Avraham walking with them to see them off." Right? We had an interlude where God speaks to God's self, but now we're sort of coming back. This is what's called resumptive repetition. That is, the Bible comes back to resume the story. It reminds you where we are and where they're going. And there are some very nice comments on Avraham standing before the Lord, remaining standing before the Lord. And let me give you one or two examples of these comments. They're very different, including one very fascinating one from the Ishbitzah, from the Meir Shiloach, who was an extremely original mind and a very profound Jewish thinker, and was not like, never makes a comment like everybody else. The Ishbitzah Rebbe, his work is called Mei HaShiloach, which, and I don't know how you would, the wells of Shiloach. He was a disciple of the Kotzker Rebbe. It's a longer discussion, but one second. I wrote down two comments, if I can find them. I don't see them, but I'll have to tell you them from memory. Where'd they go? All right. One was, which you would expect. There's the Ishbitzah. This is nice. That was for later, for his return to his place. I'm sorry. Remain standing before God. One was that he stayed the same despite the fact that he had just been standing before God. He remained, it says he remained in his place. He remained standing before the Lord. That is, he wasn't any different standing before the Lord as he was elsewhere. Even though the thoughts of the divine were revealed to him, he remained standing in the same place of humility and so on as he was before. So, and I'll return to the comment of the Mei HaShiloach a little later. Now, the reason that also that verse is in there is, what is Avraham about to do? Right, he's about to negotiate. In other words, he's about to challenge God's decision to destroy Sodom. Now, the text is sort of indicating with this that there was a moment of thought that went behind this, right? He remained standing before the Lord, and then it says Abraham came forward and said. Right? He didn't just automatically challenge. He integrated the information, and it doesn't, by the way, you'll notice it doesn't say, what Avraham's reaction, internal reaction is. We get God's internal thoughts, but we don't get Avraham's.
Good morning, students.
Okay. All right, so let's continue to read. So, let's just spend our last couple of minutes, and we'll talk more about this next time, but looking at the next two sentences and what they imply. Avraham says, will you sweep away the innocent, the guilty? What if there should be 50 innocent within the city? Will you wipe out the place and not forgive it for the sake of the innocent 50 who are in it? Now, you know he's going to get down to 10, right? There are two separate arguments contained in this. And it's interesting to think about what Avraham does say and what Avraham doesn't say. He doesn't say, first of all, if there are innocent people, please make sure you extract them before you just destroy the city. In other words, he's not only concerned about saving the innocent. He's making an argument here that will save the guilty. You realize that? Because he could make a very easy argument to God and just say, please check and make sure if there are any innocent people, get them out. But he doesn't do that. So first, he's concerned in part with making sure that the innocent are saved. But the second part is he assumes that the guilty will be saved. Why? Because of the merit of the innocent. That means that the goodness has the possibility to save evil, and it is a confirmation, actually, of Avraham's mission. What does God say? Here is an evil world, and I've chosen a good man. I'm going to send you into the world, and you're going to make it better. And this is a way of Avraham saying, you know, show me that if there are innocent people, you really will save the guilty because of them. Because this is, after all, what you're asking me to do. To go into the world and to save guilty people by my representing you in the world. But it's also true that the other thing that Avraham does not say, which you would have expected Avraham to say, being a product of the Jewish tradition, is, let me tell them to do tshuva. There are guilty people. Let me go and tell them what you're doing is wrong. Let me do what Jonah does, to say God's about to destroy this city. And if you don't repent, God is going to destroy this city. But Noah doesn't do it. Avraham doesn't do it. Right? You don't get repentance till much later in the Torah. And there is no indication that Sodom was ever warned before. When, after all, Avraham fights a battle and saves them, he doesn't say, okay, now I've saved your city, you better be good or God's going to destroy you. Instead, this is, I won't say, this is one conception, let's put it this way, of how the world is saved. One is you have to persuade wicked people to be better. The other is you have to make sure there is a sufficient number of righteous people because that can change the world. And it isn't necessarily true that you can change the wicked, but it is true that you can change the world, despite the fact that there are and always will be wicked people. So Avraham is looking for a sort of critical mass. If there are enough people who are good in this city, let's save them and work with them and see what we can do. When they finally get down to 10, God is essentially saying there aren't even enough, right, to begin to save this city. The city is doomed. And you'll see Lot's family doesn't constitute 10, although we'll come to the question of Lot next time. Well, no, remember, Avraham is supposed to create a people. That's the idea. Eventually. Right, eventually he's supposed to create a people. He's not going to save the world by himself. It's going to be the Jewish people that will spread this message to the world and so on and so forth. Yeah.
What about the children? Just because their parents are evil, does that necessarily mean they're evil?
I have a couple of unsatisfactory answers to that about the children. I mean, look, you can ask the same question about the flood, right? Here's what I think is actually the quote-unquote real answer, although not, which is that in some ways they're like extras in the movie. You know, I mean, you have a chariot race and 100 Romans get killed, but you only care that the hero lives, right? Or you have a war and you follow, you know, and they're shooting people left and right all over the place, but the guy that you care about in the war survives, so you're happy at the end of the movie. And I think that to ask about the children is to put a frame on the story that the story doesn't really intend, I think. That's one. But that, of course, is only to see it as a story. if you see it as what God really does, then you have to say that the idea here is that some societies are so irredeemably corrupt that you can't actually save. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to wipe out all the adult population and leave, you know, all the children of Sodom parentless. That is a good question, and we will absolutely return to that question, where Abraham gets the chutzpah to talk to God like that. It's a great question.
I don't know.
Right. There you go. They're in love, she said. And you know what? You want to know what José Luis Borges' definition of love was? It's a great definition of love. Love is creating a religion out of a fallible God. That's what love is, creating a religion out of a fallible God. I guess in part, there are clear connections between human love and religious love. And even the metaphors that people use are the same. I mean, if you read especially Jewish mysticism, but not only Jewish mysticism, it's filled with erotic metaphors. Well, you don't get that God is compassionate from this story, certainly. In spots, yes. The creation of the world, the creation of Adam's helpmeet, the fact that he saves Cain despite the fact that he punishes him, that he confuses the people of the Tower of Babel, he doesn't destroy them, that he saves Noah even though the world is incorruptible because he cares about human continuity, that he makes sure that Hagar is taken care of in the wilderness, and that he makes clothes for Adam and Eve. And there are lots of instances of compassion. What he's not is compassionate with evil, which is not the same. He is a God who sternly punishes evil, but that doesn't mean that he's not compassionate. Yeah. Right. Well, you see what God, if you see the opposite of compassion as apathy, yes. What you see is what Heschel called a God of pathos, of deep feeling. That's what Heschel said is the characteristic of God in the Bible. God clearly has pathos. God is not indifferent. It's not Aristotle's God. It's not a removed God. It's a passionately concerned and involved God in every step of the way. But if you think of compassion as a sort of gentle shepherding and coaxing, that's not God, certainly not in this. I mean, it's certainly not in this part of the Bible. I'll close with this, which is something that the Talmud says, and this may be the best defense of God's compassion in the case of Sodom. The Talmud says, "He who is compassionate with the cruel will end up being cruel with the compassionate." So, you know, there is something to, I mean, this is a fairly common and painful example. If you're compassionate with the husband who's an abuser, you end up being uncompassionate, whatever the opposite is, cruel to the wife who's the victim. So, maybe God would say, what Sodom would have wreaked on the world will prove the compassion that I had in destroying Sodom. But it's hard to know. It's hard to know. Okay. See you next week. God willing. If God is good.